For several days at the end of April, the town grew more crowded. The airport grew busier than usual. A rivulet, then a stream of people arrived in the hotel lobbies to check in, and tables in the outdoor cafes of restaurants downtown started to fill. The rental car companies ran out of cars. The bar at the Marriott Regency, at the time a sort of unofficial headquarters for meeting insiders, was packed. People wearing Berkshire Hathaway meeting credentials strolled through Omaha as if identifying themselves as members of a club. In Buffett's office, the phone rang with urgent last-minute requests for press credentials, meeting passes, and requests from guests to bring their own guests to the most exclusive event of the year in Omaha, Buffett's private Sunday brunch. With outward patience but increasing irritation at the more brazen requests, Buffett's secretary, Debbie Bosanek, unsnarled the bottleneck and told people no. On Friday night, Buffett made the rounds from public events to private parties. Some of his disciples, dressed in gigantic yellow foam cowboy-style hats like members of a cult, mingled with longtime shareholders and big-time money managers at the Borsheims cocktail party, where much of Omaha joined the out-of-town shareholders to scarf down free drinks and food. Susan Jacques of Borsheim staged this event, which Buffett supported because it increased turnover, despite his suspicions that a lot of freeloaders showed up. Over at the Civic Auditorium, the shareholder meeting itself, which had multiplied to include thousands of staff, vendors, and volunteer employees, acres of exhibits, flowers, and displays, truckloads of turkey sandwiches, hot dogs, and Coke, signage, exhibits, security, media, sound, video, lighting, and private parties for the vendors and helpers was designed, choreographed, and overseen by just one employee, Kelly Muchamore, whom Buffett called the Flo Ziegfeld of Berkshire Hathaway. Kelly did not even have a secretary. Technically, she was a secretary. It would take four people to replace Kelly, Buffett pointed out with pride. One side effect of this kind of praise was that it sometimes caused people to wonder whether they were getting paid a quarter of what they were worth. Buffett, however, was skilled at paying people with more praise than cash. Those who sat closest to the sun, Muchamore, Bosanek, and the receptionist, Deb Ray, were the most carnegized of all Buffett's employees. Every shareholder had heard all about how wonderful they were. The carnegizing seemed to work like a sort of sunscreen, helping protect them from Rickershauser's law of thermodynamics. Thus, they threw themselves into the fray while keeping their boss sheltered in his private cocoon down at the end of the hallway, separate from everybody else. In the weeks leading up to the meeting, they all pulled double duty. On meeting day, Deb and Debbie handled the most important VIPs in the press room, while Muchamore ran around with a walkie-talkie, field-marshaling. By 4 o'clock in the morning on Saturday, several hundred restless people wearing laminated meeting credentials on lanyards around their necks lined up outside the Civic Auditorium, waiting for the doors to open. 3 hours later, people stampeded past the guards, who checked their credentials, to claim the prime seats on the floor. After hanging their jackets and sweaters over the backs of their chairs to save seats, they made their way to the concession stands for the free breakfast of sugary sweet rolls, juice, and coffee. By 8 o'clock, it became clear that they needn't have bothered to show up before dawn. Half the seats in the house were empty. 30 minutes later, the auditorium held 9,000 people. While most CEOs would be thrilled, or horrified, at such a turnout, it didn't compare to the 15,000 who had come the year before. Attendance was down by 40%. On schedule, the auditorium darkened, and the film rolled for the pre-meeting movie, which had been growing longer with each year. It opened with a cartoon featuring Warren as a superhero, with Charlie in a supporting role, shilling for Berkshire products. Next, Judge Judy adjudicated a mock dispute over a $2 bet between Buffett and Bill Gates. Comedy videos and commercials for Berkshire products followed. Finally, Susie Buffett sang a Berkshireized version of the Coca-Cola theme song, "What the World Wants Today is Berkshire Hathaway." Around 9:30, Buffett and Munger walked onto the stage in suits and ties and looked out over the shrunken crowd of the faithful, clad in everything from business garb to shorts. Yellow foam hats bobbed here and there in the audience. After a 5-minute business meeting, the question and answer session opened as usual, with shareholders lined up at microphones positioned around the auditorium, lobbing questions on how to value stocks. Somebody asked about technology stocks. "I don't want to speculate about high tech," Buffett said. "Any time there have been real bursts of speculation, it eventually gets corrected." He compared the market to the phony riches of chain letters and Ponzi schemes. "Investors may feel richer, but they're not." Pause. "Charlie?" Munger opened his mouth. The audience perked up slightly. Munger often said, "Nothing to add," but whenever Buffett handed the microphone to him, the auditorium hummed with the subtlest sensation of danger. It was like watching an experienced lion tamer working with a chair and a whip. "The reason we use the phrase wretched excess," Munger said, "is because it produces wretched consequences. It's irrational. If you mix raisins with turds, they're still turds." The crowd gasped. Did he say turds? Did Charlie just compare internet stocks to turds in front of children who had come with their parents, not to mention in front of the press? He said turds. It took some time for the meeting to settle back into its normal rhythm. Somebody asked the silver question. Around then, people started heading down into the basement to shop for shoes and Ginsu knives and seize candies. An annual question about Buffett's silver position had become a tedious ritual. In 1997, he had announced he'd bought almost a third of the world's silver supply. Instead of bringing up recollections of Blue Eagle stamps, this announcement had sent metals enthusiasts into a frenzy over the Oracle's sudden liking for their niche. More attention was paid to this single transaction than any in Berkshire's history. Buffett was not a metals bug. He followed metals as a business, based on their supply and demand, not to speculate on them or use them as a hedge against inflation. He thought stocks of companies that could raise prices were the better hedge, even though inflation eroded their gains. He had bought the silver as a good investment, but what he really wanted was to go and visit the silver. He pictured himself in the secret London vault, smiling as he counted the gleaming bars. The silver question sent Buffett's and Munger's eyes rolling heavenward a fraction of an inch, although Buffett responded politely that owning the silver had been a dull ride. He refrained from mentioning that a visit to the silver would have livened up the ride considerably. The questions droned on as Buffett and Munger listened, unwrapping dilly bars with much rustling. Shareholders began to voice complaints. They didn't like the stock price. One said she was going to look into correspondence schools, since her Berkshire stock would no longer pay for college. Gaylord Hansen of Santa Barbara, California, stood at the microphone to harangue that he had bought BRK near its highs in 1998 because of Buffett's track record, and had come out okay only because the money he lost had been made up by 4 technology stocks. He urged Buffett to invest at least 10% of Berkshire's assets in technology. The only game in town. Isn't there enough left in your brain power to maybe pick a few? The questions kept veering along these lines. What about famous money managers like Stanley Druckenmiller, who had given in and bought technology at Soros? Given Berkshire's disappointing performance, couldn't Buffett find something new to do? If not technology, couldn't he make some international investments? It was worse than humiliating. Looking out into the audience, Buffett saw that, for the first time, some of them assumed that he was letting them down. The effort of nearly 50 years rolled backward, undone. His own shareholders turned against him. His age suddenly signified not experience, but obsolescence. In the press, people now referred to him as an old man. It seemed that the world today did not want Berkshire Hathaway. Afterward, Buffett guzzled Cherry Coke while signing autographs, then donned a baseball uniform to throw out the first pitch at the Omaha Royals game. He made another round of parties with Astrid, still wearing his baseball uniform, dilly bars dripping in his wake. He held court at Goratz with the family on Sunday night, then oversaw the board meeting, another teaching exercise, on Monday morning. Afterward, he, Susie, and the kids and their families flew to New York. By the time he was catching up with friends, eating out, and seeing shows with the family, and dutifully checking off his list the unloved annual chore of buying suits at Bergdorf's, the bathtub memory had done its work. While in New York, he also taught a session of the modern version of the Ben Graham course at Columbia and met with half a dozen journalists attending Columbia's business journalism program. Saturday morning, he summoned three members of General Rees' management to his suite at the Plaza Hotel. Ron Ferguson brought a series of PowerPoint handouts and began to pace through General Rees' string of terrible results. Buffett listened for a few minutes, frowning and fidgeting. Finally, he said, "Why don't we just jump to the end? Results had to improve. The lines of authority must be reinforced. Clients were dictating terms to General Rees, not the other way around. This must end. Somebody had to be accountable." He stopped short of telling Ferguson to retire, betrayed by his weakness for older managers. He sympathized with Ferguson, who'd suffered a subarachnoid hemorrhage in late 1999. Ferguson, who had seemed just slightly off-kilter for some time afterward, had offered to step down then. Buffett had told him no. He didn't believe in putting people out to pasture. Some of his best managers had been elderly, including Mrs. B., who had worked until age 103 and died a year later. He missed her caustic little soul, but felt great relief that she had not outwitted the terms of her non-compete. His own goal was to outlive Mrs. B., not by just a few years, but by 5 years beyond forever, as he had once feared that she would outlast him. He bragged all the time about Berkshire's geriatric crew, and his board of directors was beginning to resemble the elderly U.S. Supreme Court. Imagine, therefore, if Buffett's genie had been watching over his shoulder a few weeks later as he played bridge after dinner at Bill and Melinda Gates' house. He was answering questions in the raspy voice that meant he hadn't been sleeping, repeating that he was just fine, but clearly not enjoying himself. Sharon Osberg, who knew how to read the signs that meant Buffett was in real distress, conferred with the Gateses, who immediately summoned a doctor over Buffett's protests. The doctor was surprised that Buffett had never had a colonoscopy. He gave him a painkiller to get him home in comfort, but, he said, you really should go in and have a complete examination and a colonoscopy when you get back to Omaha. The genie would have been less tactful. Howard Buffett had had colon cancer and died of complications from it. What was Buffett thinking at age 69, never having had a colonoscopy? This was certainly not treating your body like the only car you'd ever own. A month later, BRK had recovered by nearly $5,000 a share to $60,000. Fortune magazine noticed that even though he lost his heavenly touch in 1999, Berkshire's recent 47% recovery from its March low made him a good revivalist. He would need some reviving in other ways, however. Buffett had scheduled the dread procedure at last. So much medical attention at once, only a month after the kidney stone. But a colonoscopy could be considered routine. He distracted himself by talking on the phone and playing bridge. He played helicopter on the computer. When people asked him about the upcoming procedure, he said, "I'm not the least bit worried." But he woke up from the colonoscopy to a nasty shock. A sizable, benign polyp was nesting in his gut. The polyp had taken over so much real estate that removing it would require demolishing a good chunk of the surrounding neighborhood. It had a few small friends nearby as well. This was not something to trifle with. Buffett decided to have surgery in late July, after Sun Valley. "Oh, I'm not worried at all," he said, making jokes and stressing the good results from his cardiology tests. "I never worry about my health. Unless you'd brought it up, I never would have even thought about it." But Buffett now seemed cornered into issuing press releases about his health, this one blaring in embarrassing detail, "Warren E. Buffett, chairman of Berkshire Hathaway Incorporated, New York Stock Exchange, BRKA, BRKB, expects to enter an Omaha hospital in the next month to undergo surgery to remove several benign polyps in his colon. The polyps were discovered on Monday when Mr. Buffett underwent a routine physical examination, which otherwise found him to be in excellent health. The surgery is expected to keep Mr. Buffett in the hospital for several days, after which he expects to return quickly to work. Berkshire Hathaway is releasing these facts to forestall the kind of false rumors about Mr. Buffett's health that disrupted the market for its stock earlier this year." The surgery took several hours. during which 15 inches of Buffett's innards were removed and left him marked with a 7-inch scar. He spent a week recovering at home. He also grew a beard for the first time in his life. Deprived of Berkshire Hathaway, he talked a lot on the phone. He sounded weak. "Oh, no, I'm not tired at all. I'm perfectly fine," he said. "I've lost a few pounds I needed to lose. Astrid's taking good care of me. The doctor says I can eat anything I want. By the way, did I tell you that I went into the hospital with a colon, but I came out with a semicolon?" Asked if he was concerned about a recurrence, "Oh, no, I'm not worried at all about that. I never worry about anything, you know. Incidentally, did I tell you that the anesthesiologist used to be my caddy at the country club? I told him before he put me under that I sure hope I tipped him well." Berkshire Hathaway's press release simply noted that the polyp was confirmed benign and no further treatment was required. Despite the announcement, rumors raced over the internet and around Wall Street again. Some insisted that Buffett must have had cancer. Polyps did not require surgery. But Warren was not sick and certainly did not feel old. He still felt like the firebolt. Yet after tolerating cavalier treatment all his life, his health was beginning to set limits. Someday, his wrestling match with infinity would end. The questions he was avoiding must be faced. Since Berkshire and Buffett were interchangeable in his mind, everything in his nature rebelled against this task. Many of the questions hinged on Big Susie, who was going to outlive him. He told people that she would take care of everything. Chapter 55. The Last K Party. Omaha, September 2000 to July 2001. By the time Buffett got his semicolon, the internet boom had boomeranged. The dot-coms were dying at a pace of one a day. Arzu.com, Boom.com, Dash.com, eToys.com, Flues.com, Fudu.com, Hooked.com, Lipstream.com, Paperfly.com, Pets.com, Whirr.com, Zuma.com, Zing.com. The Nasdaq was trading at less than half the value of its peak. The old economy stocks were still swooning. The Federal Reserve had started to cut interest rates once again. Buffett's reputation, however, began to revive. Berkshire dipped its soup ladle into a huge stockpot of capital for Buffett to buy private companies, bankrupt companies, under-the-radar companies, as the window to invest began to open again. He bought U.S. Liability, an insurer of unusual risks, Ben Bridge, another jeweler, and Justin Industries, parent of Acme Brick and Tony Lama and Nakono Boots, Shaw, the world's largest carpet maker, and Benjamin Moore Paint. He bought Johns Manville, a home-building products maker, and Mitek, a high-tech steel component fabricator. Even so, by the end of 2000, Berkshire still had billions of unused capital, a bailed-in-the-basement, batched to the rafters, wadded to the walls, stashed up the chimney, thatched to the rooftop mass of money that continued to pour out from the self-perpetuating cash-spinning machine. Buffett's foreboding prediction about the market in his 1999 Sun Valley speech had proven right so far. Now he sermonized in his letter, which had become a global media event, released on the internet and awaited by so many thousands of people that the Berkshire website nearly crashed on the appointed Saturday morning, that the birth of the internet was a chance for cynical financiers to monetize the hopes of the credulous. He alluded again to the Aesop's fable he had invoked in his Sun Valley speech. Investing in the internet is laying out the bird in the hand, money today, to get birds in the bush. The resulting wealth transfer on a massive scale was going to benefit only the very few. By shamelessly merchandising birdless bushes, promoters have in recent years moved billions of dollars from the pockets of the public to their own purses and to those of their friends and associates. Speculation is most dangerous when it looks easiest. The audience listened, and at the 2001 shareholder meeting, the crowd started coming back. A small part of Berkshire's good fortune came from a turnaround at Gillette, where Buffett had been instrumental in replacing its CEO, Mike Hawley, with Jim Kilts. Shortly before that, near the end of 2000, he had thrown off his torpor as a Coca-Cola board member once again when Doug Daft, the new CEO, tried to make a deal to buy Quaker Oats. Buffett was one of several board members whose lack of support spiked the deal. But it remained to be seen whether the changes at Coca-Cola would make a difference. Certainly, replacing one ham sandwich with another had not helped the stock. Buffett's return to Sun Valley in 2001 was another opportunity to table thump. But as the Gulfstream jets glided their way down the mountain wave to Haley, the corporate chiefs heading to the Sun Valley Lodge had deals on their mind, and rumors were flying. Most of the rumors concerned AT&T fighting off an unfriendly offer for its cable assets from Comcast. For the first time, an archipelago of television news tents filled the lawn in front of the Sun Valley Inn, equipped as though for a movie shoot with distracting lights, silver reflecting sheets, producers, cameramen, assistants, makeup people, and reporters, all waiting to wrestle CEOs into giving interviews. They fueled the rumor mill. TV cameras hovered around the duck pond. Reporters pounced on the willing and unwilling after their speeches. They chased after people from companies that were supposedly involved in the deals. On Friday afternoon, after playing bridge, Catherine Graham, who was now left in relative peace at the age of 84, rode back to her condo in the little golf cart she used to get around in Sun Valley. Tall and still on the slender side, she had had both hips replaced, and one worked better than the other. People noticed that she seemed worn out and fading, but she had been saying what a marvelous time she was having this year. The company that she and her son Don had created, with much help from Buffett's advice, was now regarded almost as iconic for its financial and journalistic success at a time when newspaper profits were slipping badly. Graham took obvious pleasure in the way the Allen Conference brought together so many of the people she enjoyed. She had been assigned an assistant to escort her everywhere, but she had the grit to resist handling, so for much of the conference she was seen on the arm of either Don or Barry Diller, chairman of USA Networks and a close friend. At the moment, however, she was alone. Susie Buffett Jr. and her mother, in their car, spotted Graham and drove into the employee parking lot where Graham could not see them so that they could watch her climb the four steps to her condominium. She was taking the anticoagulant Coumadin, which greatly increased the risk of serious hemorrhage should she fall. She clung to the handrail and looked shaky, but made it inside without incident. Later, outside on the deck of the Wildflower condos, overlooking the golf course and mountains, where Graham often sat reading the Washington Post in the afternoons, fashion designer Diane von Furstenberg threw her annual women's cocktail party for Kay, a Sun Valley tradition. Susie Buffett brought See's lollipops, and they all gathered around Graham for a picture with lollipops in their mouths. After a while, Don Keough, Diane's husband Barry Diller, News Corporation CEO Rupert Murdoch, and several of the other men crashed the party and joined Don Graham. Saturday dawned. The audience settled into its chairs to hear Andy Grove, head of Intel, kicking off the morning with Internet Interrupted. Then Diane Sawyer moderated a panel asking Meg Whitman of eBay, Sir Howard Stringer, CEO of Sony, and AOL Time Warner's Steve Case, "Pulse of America, how do you find it?" Sun Valley frothed and bubbled like a junior high school cafeteria being filmed for a documentary, with reporters round-robining rumors that USA Networks, or AOL Time Warner, or Disney, or Charter Communications, or some combination of them, were going to hook up with AT&T broadband. Many of those present wished the television tents would disappear. After Diane Sawyer, Buffett was once again the scheduled speaker. Since the market's peak in March 2000, over $4 trillion of stock market value had evaporated. At least 112,000 dot-com employees had been fired. Meanwhile, the surviving Internet businesses were entering their adolescence. Surely, some reasoned, he would no longer think Internet stocks overvalued. The audience was hoping he would relent from his previous bearishness. Yet Buffett showed them a graph indicating that the value of the market was still one-third larger than the economy. That was far higher than the level at which Buffett said he would buy stocks. It was considerably higher than the market had ever stood in modern history, higher even than the peak of the great bubble of 1929. In fact, the graph suggested that the economy would have to nearly double, or the value of the market would have to fall by nearly half, before he would get really excited about it. He told them that despite 2 years of keel hauling, even with the Nasdaq down by more than half, he would still not buy. He expected the stock market, with dividends included, to grow at no better than about 7% a year, on average, for possibly as long as the next 20 years. That was only about 1% higher than he had said 2 years before. It was a dispiriting message, most of all to Buffett himself, who was about to celebrate his 71st birthday, and to the track record he wanted to maintain. "That shouldn't be the way markets work," he said, "but that is the way markets work. And in the end, that's what you should remember." He put up a slide. "Anything that can't go on forever will end. Herb Stein." Many in the audience were shocked and sobered, but impressed. "You basically have to listen to Warren," said Jeff Bezos, CEO of Amazon.com. Amazon was trading at $17, down from $113 at its high. "Some things he said were quite painful, but by God, the man is a genius and so far seems to be right." Buffett enjoyed congratulations for his speech at lunch under a tent on the deck behind Herbert Allen's condo, where a group of about 100 people, including the Grahams, had gathered. He sat with President Vicente Fox of Mexico, whom he thought of as an old Coca-Cola guy, and kicked around the economy. Then he went off to play golf. Kay Graham rode over to the bridge room to play cards. After a while, she said she was not feeling well and had decided to go back to her room. She called to alert her assistant, whom she had left waiting for her at Herbert Allen's condo next door to her own, then walked out to her golf cart and drove back to her condo alone. The assistant had started to check out the window for her every couple of minutes. She looked and saw that Kay's golf cart had already arrived, but it was empty. She sprinted outside and saw Kay lying at the top of the steps on the porch in front of her door. Running over, she bent and spoke to Graham, who didn't respond. She started screaming for Herbert Allen to come out. By the time the emergency medical technicians arrived a few minutes later, Don Graham had rushed back from the golf course. He was going to need someone to help him make decisions, and asked Buffett whether he wanted to come along. But Buffett could not do it. Griffith Harsh, a prominent neurosurgeon who was married to eBay CEO Meg Whitman, went with Don to look at the CAT scan at St. Luke's Hospital in Ketchum, about 10 minutes away. Susie Jr. drove off to meet Don and Herbert Allen at the hospital. She knew very well that no one could expect her father to deal with any kind of medical crisis. Big Susie had had a cardiac catheterization in 1997, and Warren got on a plane to go to San Francisco to be with her. When Kathleen Cole called to say that Susie was going to be okay, he turned the plane around in midair and went back to Omaha. Since then, Susie had been in the emergency room repeatedly with excruciating abdominal adhesions and intestinal blockages. In 1999, she had her gallbladder removed. Throughout all of her medical problems over the years, Warren had never once been able to endure the emotional distress of going to the hospital to be with his wife. Shortly after he and Don arrived at St. Luke's and the radiologist took the CAT scan, Dr. Harsh saw it and said, "Kay needs to get to a trauma center." The hospital helicoptered her to St. Alphonsus Regional Medical Center in Boise. Herbert Allen arranged a private plane, somewhat bigger than a riding lawnmower and flown by a couple of cowboys in jeans and t-shirts, to take Don and Susie to Boise. While all of this was transpiring, Warren retreated to his condo. Big Susie had left earlier that day for a wedding in Greece and knew nothing of what was going on. Peter and Jennifer, Howie and Devin were still at Sun Valley. Peter and Howie came by briefly, but even at such a time, it was unnatural for Warren to tune the unfamiliar instrument of his emotions to make an open-hearted connection with his sons. Sharon Osberg was not at Sun Valley, nor, of course, was Astrid. With both his wife and his daughter also unavailable to him, it was Bill and Melinda Gates, Ron and Jane Olson, and Susie Jr.'s boyfriend who sat with him waiting for news of Kay. Their job was to help distract him from what was going on by talking of anything but her. Susie Jr. had called from Boise to say that she was going into surgery, but that was all. Kay was taken into the operating room, then brought out. Around midnight, Dr. Harsh came by to tell Don and Susie that things looked worse and Kay needed another CAT scan. They wheeled the gurney back into surgery and handed her watch to Susie Jr., who felt her stomach drop. Around 2 o'clock in the morning, since there had been no further word from Boise, Buffett decided to go to bed. Everybody left. 90 minutes or so later, the doctors moved Kay to intensive care. "We're not really sure what's going to happen," they said. Susie Jr. called her father and woke him up. She told him to get the family on the plane. Buffett had to call everyone and organize their departure. A couple of hours later, when the NetJets plane taxied into Boise, Warren called Susie Jr. and said he didn't feel he could come to the hospital. She told him that he had to come. Don was distraught and needed him to be there. Even if Kay was not conscious and couldn't see him, she would be able to sense his presence. Reluctantly, he acquiesced. When he got to the hospital, his daughter met him downstairs in the lobby. She knew he was so frightened that he would have to be coaxed. "You have to come upstairs," she insisted. "You have to come." She led him to intensive care, where Don Graham, red-faced from weeping, was sitting alone with his mother. Kay, drained of color and unconscious, lay connected to monitoring devices that blinked little lights and made tiny noises. There was an oxygen mask over her mouth. Warren and Don clung to each other, sobbing. Lally Weymouth, Kay's oldest child and only daughter, arrived. Eventually, Susie Jr. took her father downstairs. There was nothing more they could do. As the rest of Kay's children gathered in Boise, the Buffetts boarded a plane for a sad ride back to Omaha. 2 days later, the call came that Kay had died. Warren had already told Lally that he wasn't going to be able to speak at Kay's service. He would be an usher, along with Bill Gates. Astrid took care of him at home, and work consumed him at the office. When he wasn't working, Sharon played bridge with him, or he played helicopter, anything to distract himself from the many shocks and horror of Kay's death. So sudden, on such a happy occasion, not being there when it happened, the ambulance, the helicopter, Susie Jr. calling about the surgery, sitting in the condo waiting, the phone call in the middle of the night, flying to Boise not knowing, going upstairs to see Kay lying so still and white, barely breathing, the normally controlled Don Graham so distraught, the terrible trip home away from Kay, whom he would never see again, the phone call with the news. No big Susie to shepherd him through it all. No more Kay. No more Kay parties. Never again. And yet, the day after Graham died, Buffett arrived, as scheduled, to speak to an audience of college students at the Terry College of Business at the University of Georgia. He climbed onto the stage wearing his stiff gray suit and looking only a little more awkward than usual, his breathy voice grating slightly. "Testing? 1 million? 2 million? 3 million? He said at the microphone. This line could always be counted on to get a laugh, and it did. He then launched into a couple of Nebraska football jokes, but, out of character, rushed the punchline and got only chuckles from the audience. Then he seemed to catch his rhythm. "People ask me where they should go to work, and I always tell them to go to work for whom they admire the most," he said. He urged them not to waste their time and their life. "It's crazy to take little in-between jobs just because they look good on your resume. That's like saving sex for your old age. Do what you love and work for whom you admire the most, and you've given yourself the best chance in life you can." They asked him what mistakes he had made. "Number one was Berkshire Hathaway," he said, "spending 20 years trying to revive a failing textile mill. Second, U.S. Air." Buffett spoke of his failure to call the Aeroholic hotline beforehand. "Third," he said, "had been buying the Sinclair gas station as a young man. That mistake, he reckoned, had cost him about $6 billion compared to what he could have earned on the money invested. But his mistakes of omission, things he could have done and didn't do, had plagued him the most," he said. He mentioned only one, failing to buy FNMA stock, the Federal National Mortgage Association. That, he said, had cost about $5 billion as of that date. There were others, passing on the television station that Tom Murphy had tried to sell him, not investing in Walmart. The reason that he had made mostly mistakes of omission instead of commission, he explained, was his cautious approach to life. Buffett had talked many times before about mistakes, but when he spoke, as he often did, of his mistakes of omission, he never ventured beyond business mistakes. The errors of omission in his personal life, inattention, neglect, missed chances, were always there, the side effects of intensity, but they were shadow presences visible only to those who knew him well. He spoke of them only in private, if at all. To the students, he explained his 20 punches approach to investing. "You'd get very rich," he said, "if you thought of yourself as having a card with only 20 punches in a lifetime, and every financial decision used up one punch. You'd resist the temptation to dabble. You'd make more good decisions, and you'd make more big decisions." He ran his life on 20 punches, too, with as little flitting as he could arrange. Same house, same wife for 50 years, same Astrid on Farnham Street. No desire to buy and sell real estate, art, cars, tokens of wealth. No jumping from city to city or career to career. Some of that was easy for a man so certain of himself. Some of it came with being a creature of habit. Some of it was a natural tendency to let things compound. And some of it was the wisdom of inertia. When he gave somebody a punch on his card, they became a part of him, and that decision was permanent. Any crack in the facade of permanence was extraordinarily difficult for him to face. A few days later, police arrived early in the morning to close nearby streets for the crowd they expected at the Washington National Cathedral, its gargoyle-bedecked flying buttresses silhouetted against a bright blue sky. Television crews began to set up for an elaborately orchestrated event that had all the trappings of a funeral for a head of state. By late morning, buses bearing Washington Post employees pulled up one by one. A blue and white striped bus carrying members of the Senate arrived, and people began streaming in from cars and limousines. Gradually, the front pews filled with dignitaries like Bill and Hillary Clinton and Lynn and Dick Cheney. Around the cathedral, famous faces were everywhere, Supreme Court Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer, celebrity journalists Charlie Rose, Tom Brokaw, Mike Wallace, and Ted Koppel, USA Today publisher Al Newhart, Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan and his wife, journalist Andrea Mitchell, editor Tina Brown, Senator Ted Kennedy, Congressional Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton. Hundreds, then thousands of people filed in through the enormous bronze doors to the sound of the National Symphony Orchestra and the Kennedy Center Opera House Orchestra Brass Ensemble, gradually assembling into what looked like the largest crowd the cathedral had ever held. From the nave, thousands of men in dark suits and white shirts formed a Mondrian backdrop for the women, a pointillist grid of black and white. The women wore houndstooth check and crisp seersucker, black suits with dainty white cotton blouses, sleeveless black sheaths with jackets, and sleeveless black sheaths with bare arms, white skirts with black sweaters, and black jackets over dotted Swiss and black and white polka-dotted dresses. Their heads were topped with small black hats with discreet netting, black and white picture hats fit for Ladies' Day at Ascot, black straw bonnets with swooping veils. The cathedral was awash in a sea of pearls, from pearls as small as peppercorns to pearls like huge champagne corks, black and white pearls on hundreds of wrists, necks, and earlobes, women wearing strands of pearls the width of a lingerie strap, a curtain tieback, a first prize ribbon. Every detail paid tribute to the woman who had awed the world for years in a summation and celebration of her life that had become the second, the grandest, the most stately, and the final black and white ball. As the service began, Buffett and Gates slipped into a pew next to Melinda. The music started. Historian Arthur Schlesinger spoke. Henry Kissinger spoke. Ben Bradley spoke. Graham's children spoke. Near the end, former Senator John Danforth gave the homily. Graham, he thought, never said much about religion, but she lived the way a believer is supposed to live. "She dismissed out of hand the notion that she was the most powerful woman in the world," he said. "In Washington, especially, a lot of people strut, and Kay did not strut. We do not attain the victory of life by selfishness. Victory is for those who give themselves to causes beyond themselves. It is very biblical and very true that everyone who exalts themselves will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. That is a text for all of us. It was lived by Catherine Graham. Melinda Gates reached up and wiped away tears while Buffett sat next to her husband with a frostbitten, grief-stricken face. The two cathedral choirs, dressed in black and white robes, sang Mozart. Carefully, the pallbearers lifted the casket to their shoulders and bore it down the aisle while the congregation sang America the Beautiful. The family followed the procession out of the cathedral to the Oak Hill Cemetery across the street from Graham's house, where she would be interred next to her late husband. Early that afternoon, more than 400 people swept up the circular driveway to Graham's house and walked around to the rear garden, where her children and grandchildren stood about, chatting with guests. At a buffet inside the tent, people ate finger sandwiches and sliced ham and tenderloin. They wandered around past the swimming pool and found their way into the house to gather the collection of memories that it held. They stood in the living room, where President Ronald Reagan had gotten down on his hands and knees to pick up ice cubes he'd spilled on the floor, and gazed for one last time at the books and knick-knacks in the library where Mrs. Graham had pondered whether to print the Pentagon Papers. They paused by Napoleon's china on the walls next to the round dining tables in the golden room where American presidents from Kennedy to Clinton had dined. From Jacqueline Onassis to Princess Diana, if Catherine Graham invited them, they all came. The house itself was a kind of history. Warren walked through Kay's house for one last time to remember, but he did not linger. He left early and would never return. As the afternoon wore on, the rest of Catherine Graham's friends and admirers told her goodbye. They withdrew down the long hallway gallery past the rooms where she had entertained them so often and slipped past the garden outside. Then slowly, sometimes reluctantly, they left the last K party and began their final trip down the pebbled drive. Chapter 56. By the Rich, for the Rich. Omaha, July 2001 to July 2002. Buffett flew back to Nebraska alone. He knotted every waking minute into a web of distractions. He read the financial reports that came into his office. He read the Financial Times, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal. He watched CNBC. He talked to people on the phone. He played bridge in the evenings after work. He surfed the internet for news online. In between, he played helicopter on the computer. A week later, he was crying on the phone, great gulping sobs, choking, gasping cries that left him out of breath. The convulsion broke through the dam that had kept his grief contained. A moment later, after the torrent of grief had poured out of him, he was recovered enough to speak. He regretted not being able to eulogize Kay at her funeral, he said. It shamed him. The man who had worked so hard to become comfortable on a stage felt that he should have been able to do that for Kay. And there would be more regrets, more second thoughts. If I'd been playing bridge with her that day, she might not have fallen, he reflected later, sadly. I would have taken her back in her golf cart myself. She might not have died. But Kay probably would have walked up the steps by herself anyway, and nobody knew whether she died from the fall or whether she had fallen because she had a stroke. Still, Warren was plagued by a sense of lost opportunities. He felt at times that, had he been with her, he could somehow have kept Kay safe. As weeks passed, if her death was mentioned, his eyes teared and the conversation would come to a stop while he collected himself. Then, like a motor turning over and restarting, he would brighten and shift to other subjects. During August, other events helped to turn his mind away from the tragedy. He was planning the 10th and final Omaha Classic Charity Golf Tournament, which would take place in September. And he was already looking forward to the Buffett Group meeting in Biarritz, France, in October. In the meantime, he flew to Cody, Wyoming, with Big Susie for a long weekend at Herbert Allen's J. Bar 9 Ranch on the North Fork of the Shoshone River. Buffett would much rather watch a Western movie than visit a dude ranch. But as with Sun Valley, he went for the mix of elephant bumping and people he considered friends. At Cody, he and Susie spent a leisurely, relaxed time with media CEO Barry Diller and his wife Diane von Furstenberg, Don and Mickey Keough, film director Mike Nichols and his wife, newscaster Diane Sawyer, producer Sidney Pollack, actress Candace Bergen, and Intel CEO Andy Grove and his wife Eva, among others. The Buffetts arrived late in the evening and spent the first night in one of the hand-hewn cedar-shake log cabins that encircled the central lodge. They began the next morning greeting other early arrivals over breakfast, which for Warren usually meant last night's leftover dessert. The rest of the day, as guests trickled in, he relaxed in the lodge or his cabin, reading books, playing bridge on the computer, and reading the newspapers that Alan had printed off the internet for him. The others began to entertain themselves with trail rides up the canyon on some of Alan's ranch geldings to see the elk and deer. Some people headed off on mountain bike expeditions or went fishing in the river that ran through the property. Buffett skipped all of this. But at mealtime, he appeared at the long rectangular table in the lodge, where the guests sat surrounded by dark leather furniture and romantic rustic paintings by Thomas Hart Benton and Frederick Remington. Buffett presided over a salon at the dinner table, talking politics, money, and world affairs. While the rest ate fish, chicken, game, and salads, the cook at Cody challenged his appetite with huge slabs of meat. After dinner, Alan's friend Al Early took over at the piano. The guests sang from Candace Bergen's songbook, standards by Gershwin, Irving Berlin, and Cole Porter. Susie often sang solos. Buffett played his ukulele and, as he did every year, sang a duet of the Hutsut song, an appalling number from the 1941 hit parade, with movie producer Sidney Pollack, a performance always dreaded by the audience, which made him look forward to singing it all the more. Hutsut rawlson on the rillera, and a brawla brawla suet. Hutsut rawlson on the rillera, and a brawla suet. The return from Cody effectively marked the end of Buffett's summer vacation. His birthday would be arriving in a few weeks, something to which he feigned indifference but actually dreaded. The one highlight was hundreds of cards, gifts, and letters from friends, or by now mostly strangers, that poured into Kiewit Plaza every year for weeks beforehand. Buffett was far from jaded, but it was hard to thrill a multi-billionaire, one who didn't want to be a year older and cared nothing about possessions, with a birthday gift. He appreciated the cards and letters, the sentimental, and was touched by anything unique that reminded him of past episodes of his life. Otherwise, he had so much Coca-Cola memorabilia by now, so many Nebraska football posters, so many flags, quilts, paintings, collages, and other tributes to him, and photographs of himself with other famous people, that there was hardly any space left on an entire floor of hallways. His actual birthday was a low-key event, usually just dinner at some place like the Olive Garden with family and perhaps a few friends. This year he was turning 71. He could not believe he was 71. He could not believe it either when he'd turned 40 and 50 and 60 and 70. But this year especially he did not want to think about his birthday, because he did not want any reminders of time passing so soon after Kay's death. Fortunately, the Omaha Classic Golf Tournament, an annual event that the Buffetts sponsored to benefit various local institutions, followed his birthday like recess after study hall. Corporate CEOs and celebrities, friends and relatives, people he knew and enjoyed, were coming to play golf and tennis at the Omaha Country Club. The guests at this event were another collection, like his shareholders, like the people who came to Omaha for his shareholder meeting, like the members of the Buffett Group. As the days counted down, the staff juggled shifting guest lists, airport transportation, and food and entertainment for golfers at the club. Buffett enjoyed knowing the details, who would come, how many times a guest had come before, who was attending for the first time, and how much money the event would raise. Most of the guests arrived Monday evening for a dinner at the Omaha Country Club with entertainment by Academy Award-winning songwriter Marvin Hamlisch. Every year he sat at the piano and made up personal songs on the spot for anyone who asked. He didn't play golf. He came to the tournament some years ago, and he likes Little Sue's, and she likes him. And he said, "Why don't you let me do a little show the night before for the people who come in early?" It got to be the best part of the golf tournament. You say, "I wish I could get rid of that damn hook that I have with my 3-wood," and it's a song. People thought it was rigged. It wasn't rigged. If you said, "I can't believe my mother-in-law steals the sugar packets from restaurants," 30 seconds later, he's banging out a little tune and singing a song to that refrain. The next morning dawned under a flawless blue dome of sky. Around 8 o'clock, Buffett's phone rang. It was Devin Spurgeon, a Wall Street Journal reporter who'd been covering Berkshire Hathaway. "Oh my God, Warren, turn on the TV," she said. He turned it on to a news channel. At opposite ends of the phone line, they watched what appeared to be a horrible aviation accident. The cameras were running footage that panned across the North Tower of the World Trade Center, whose upper stories were slashed through by a jagged, gaping wedge of flames. An airplane appeared, circled toward the building, and plunged into the side of the South Tower, exploding in a corona of flames like a bomb going off. They watched in silence as the news channel began repeating the footage. Plane turns, dives into building. Plane turns, dives into building. "Devin," said Buffett, "the world has changed." He started asking her about her office, which was 2 blocks from the Sears Tower in Chicago. "Listen," he said, "that's not a safe place to be. The Wall Street Journal headquarters in New York was across the street from the World Trade Center. They discussed the fact that the Journal staff must be evacuating and reporting at the same time." Spurgeon could hear Buffett switching as they spoke into his fastest-thinking, most rational, problem-solving mode. As he was hanging up the phone, the FAA halted all flight operations at U.S. airports, and minutes later, American Flight 77 crashed into the Pentagon. About 15 minutes after that, while the White House was evacuating, Buffett, his mind latticing bits of information into a plan, called General Ree, where he was supposed to be speaking the next day to a group of employees. He said that he was still planning to fly out to Connecticut if the airports reopened and flights resumed. General Ree and its neighbor in Connecticut, Ogget James Berkshire Ree, were both international gateways to ensuring potential losses from terrorism. Meeting with them now would enable him to talk with his managers about suddenly significant issues at a critical time. While Buffett was working out logistics with General Ree, the South Tower, burning from inside, collapsed, as did a portion of the Pentagon. Within minutes, United Airlines Flight 93 crashed near Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Over the next half hour, government buildings were evacuated and the North Tower collapsed. The New York Stock Exchange closed, and civilians fled the clouds of smoke and debris in Lower Manhattan. Almost everyone in Omaha at the golf tournament was affected in some way or another, however remotely. Many had friends, relatives, neighbors, or business acquaintances who worked in the towers. The tournament staff took care of their needs and helped them with logistics. One, Ann Tatlock, the CEO of Fiduciary Trust, which was headquartered in the Trade Center, spent the rest of the day in her hotel room making phone calls. About 100 Fiduciary Trust employees would prove to be missing. Berkshire, of course, had employees and businesses scattered all across the country. In the end, Buffett would find that Berkshire had lost no employees, only money. Some people decided to leave the golf tournament immediately, but with all airports closed, this was not easy. A few started making arrangements to rent cars and leave. Others stayed. Some because they didn't want to insult Buffett, many because they had no choice. Radio commentator Rush Limbaugh, on the way to the tournament, had turned his plane around in midair and headed back to New York. While these momentous events were occurring, Buffett proceeded with his schedule, compartmentalizing as he did under stress, even in extreme situations. He arranged to complete the acquisition of a small business that was already in process. Then he went ahead with a meeting that had been scheduled with the head of Home Depot, Bob Nardelli. Afterward, he showed up at the Omaha Country Club, where about 100 guests were milling around or dining on hamburgers and ice cream. Buffett said that things would go on as planned, but people should do whatever they needed or wanted to do. Guests wandered in and out of the club making calls and checking the news on television. Tony Passavento and Gary Wyron, the local pros, followed lunch with a golf lesson, and the tournament got rolling in a surreal atmosphere. Buffett rode a golf cart through a planned circuit of stops at different tees so guests could have their picture taken with him. A strange calm hung over the event, which was like a celebrity golf tournament the day Pearl Harbor was attacked. And in fact, like Buffett, more than a few of the golfers could remember Pearl Harbor and its aftermath. This was not an excitable crowd. Most of them were prominent businessmen accustomed to stress and pressure from a generation of men that considered poise and equanimity in the face of disaster as essential as the suits and ties they wore every day to work. Buffett had fallen automatically into statesman mode, moving through his routine with smooth composure. Even so, his brain was busy turning over the threat of terrorism and its broader implications for weapons of mass destruction, as well as the possible effect this would have on the economy. He was more prepared for this than most because he had already been thinking about terrorism risk. In May, he had told General Ree and Berkshire Ree to cut back on insuring buildings and clients that represented a concentration of exposure to terrorism risk, his mind working as it always did to extrapolate toward potential catastrophes. He had actually cited the World Trade Center as an example of a building complex where a cluster of clients might create too much risk. While the rising threat of terrorism in the late 1990s and early millennium years was no secret, Buffett's attempt to protect Berkshire against the danger had been unusually prescient and probably unique among insurers. All day long, Buffett had been thinking about what to say that evening after dinner. He knew that the stock market, which was closed, would plunge as soon as it reopened. He realized that the innocence of the United States had now been shattered, and the government would be grappling with an unseen enemy. He saw his role as to convey his thoughts on what all of this meant. The guests who attended the dinner that night watched President Bush's speech on a giant TV screen, then heard Buffett speak about terrorism, contrasting it with conventional war. "Terrorists have a huge advantage. They pick the time, the place, and the means. It's very difficult to defend against fanatics. This is just the start of things. We don't know who our enemy is. Now it's us versus a shadow. There could be many shadows." The following morning, and over the next few days, as airports gradually began to allow flights to resume on a limited schedule, the Buffetts organized dinners, tennis, and golf for the remaining guests until everyone was able to straggle home from Omaha. With the cleanup underway in Lower Manhattan and missing posters going up all over New York City, Buffett considered how he could use his nationally recognized reputation to help the country. The stock market was about to reopen after its longest recess since the Great Depression. He agreed to go on 60 Minutes with former Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin and Jack Welch, the recently retired CEO of General Electric. Americans would recognize him as an expert on investing in the stock market more than anyone else. On the show that Sunday evening, Buffett said that he would not be selling stocks. He might be a buyer if they declined enough, and explained that he had confidence in the ability of the United States economy to surmount the ripples from the terrorist attack. By now, Warren Buffett's reputation for honesty, built over decades, was known to anyone who cared about the stock market. When he said something, people knew he meant it. At Sun Valley, of course, Buffett had said the value of the market would need to fall by half before he would get really excited. So when he said he might be a buyer if stocks declined enough, the savvy knew he meant it, but they also knew enough meant a hell of a lot. The next day, the Dow fell 684 points, or 7%, its largest point decline ever in a single day. The Federal Reserve began to take action after the market plunged on its reopening, cutting interest rates 50 basis points, half a percent. By the end of the week, the Dow had fallen more than 14%, its largest one-week drop in history. Yet the drop as a percent of investors' wealth was less than half of that of 1987, when the market plunged by one-third. From the time trading opened, sellers concentrated on sectors like insurers and airlines, where the most serious financial consequences would be. People were less panicked than they were groping in the dark to try to make intelligent guesses about the unknowable. Within days, as barricades and new security gates were installed all over Manhattan amid bomb scares, and the Buffett Group trip to Biarritz was canceled, Buffett talked to Berkshire's insurers and tried to assess the damage to Berkshire Hathaway. The initial estimates, which would later be revised slightly upward, indicated that Berkshire had lost $2.3 billion. This was many times its largest loss from any earthquake, hurricane, tornado, or other natural disaster to date. Of the total, $1.7 billion came from General Re. Buffett had had enough. He went to work writing a special letter that he posted on his website, excoriating General Re for having broken the basic rules of underwriting. Since he had never, in the history of Berkshire Hathaway, publicly dressed down the management of one of his companies, the effect was to brand General Re with a red ink scarlet letter, which remained posted on the website for all to see. It was now in a precarious situation. Having publicly embarrassed Buffett in such a dramatic way, it risked becoming the next Solomon, a business that he could never embrace, that would instead become only another cautionary tale. After the stock market crash of 1987, and then again after the collapse of long term, the Federal Reserve had slashed interest rates three times within 7 weeks, priming the market pump with easy money. Now, to prevent panic, the Fed took interest rates down to historically low levels once again. The Fed's role was to maintain the banking system's liquidity. This time, however, the Fed would keep interest rates artificially low for 3 years. Fueled by cheap money, 1 month after the attacks, stocks completed a full recovery, restoring $1.38 trillion in market value. But the upheaval was far from over, and the market remained in a nervous mood, partly due to uncertainty over the outcome of the United States and British invasion of Afghanistan a few weeks after 9/11. Then in November, an energy trading company called Enron stuck a pin in the remains of the late 1990s stock market bubble, which had shrunk but not burst. As the Justice Department moved in, Enron melted into bankruptcy in the heat of an accounting fraud. Enron was an extreme but not isolated situation. The excesses of the stock market bubble and the opportunity for executives to pillage their companies led to a whole series of accounting fraud and securities violation cases. WorldCom, Adelphia Communications, Tyco, Imclone. As 2002 began, New York Attorney General Elliot Spitzer mounted a blitzkrieg assault against the Wall Street banks for having inflated stock prices by touting new offerings during the internet bubble using biased stock research. Valuations of stocks and bonds began to fall apart as investors lost confidence in the numbers reported to them by managements. Berkshire's best opportunities always came at times of uncertainty, when others lacked the insight, resources, and fortitude to make the right judgments and commit. "Cash combined with courage in a crisis is priceless," said Buffett. Now his time had come round again. Anyone of normal energy might have been overwhelmed, but Buffett had been waiting for years for the kind of opportunities that sleeted down upon Kiewit Plaza. Every one of his faculties seemed engaged at once. He bought a group of junk bonds, which had become cigar butts, for Berkshire. He bought the underwear maker Fruit of the Loom, quipping, "We cover the asses of the masses." He bought Larsen Jewell, which made picture frames. Berkshire's Mid-American Energy subsidiary invested in the troubled Williams Companies and bought its Kern River pipeline. Berkshire bought Garan, the maker of Garanimal's children's clothing. It picked up the Northern Natural Gas pipeline from Dynegy, another troubled energy company. Within days, Mid-American lent more money to Williams Companies. It bought the Pampered Chef, which sold cookware at parties through a sales force of 70,000 independent kitchen consultants. It bought farm equipment maker CTB Industries and teamed with investment bank Lehman Brothers to lend $1.3 billion to struggling Reliant Energy. Ajit Jain quickly moved into the terrorism insurance business, filling a sudden vacuum by insuring airlines, Rockefeller Center, the Chrysler Building, a South American oil refinery, a North Sea oil platform, and the Sears Tower in Chicago. Berkshire was paid to unburden the Olympics of the dubious risk that either the games would be canceled or the U.S. would not show up, at least twice before 2012. It ensured the Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City against a terrorist attack. It ensured the FIFA World Cup Soccer Championship against terrorism. Buffett was handicapping. Some of Berkshire's businesses struggled in a weak economy. Buffett had always said he'd rather have a lumpy 15% return than a steady 10%. It didn't bother him. Most would naturally right themselves over time. NetJets, however, was struggling, not just because of the economy, but because the premise for buying it, the uniqueness of its franchise, was looking less unique. Other people who forgot to call the Aeroholic hotline kept setting up businesses to compete with NetJets, even though the economics of the fractional aviation business were unattractive. Buffett now realized that it was testosterone that caused aeroholism. If only women could be CEOs of companies that flew planes, he said, I think it would be a lot better. It's like sports franchises. If only women could own sports franchises, they'd sell for 1/10 of what they sell for now. He told the shareholders that NetJets would return to profitability and would dominate its market. He did not point out, however, that it might not earn the margin on capital he had hoped, at least not any time soon. It was a letdown, but still a lot better than a money-losing textile mill. Besides, NetJets was fun. He knew mountains of minutiae about how the planes were purchased, managed, scheduled, routed, maintained, insured, piloted, crewed, and even how the pilots were trained. NetJets was cool. He did a lot of elephant bumping at NetJets events. He would never sell it, even if the world's other mega-billionaires tried to arm-wrestle him for it. The more serious, if smaller, problem was Dexter Shoe, the modern equivalent of the textile mill. Buffett would later say it was the worst acquisition he had ever made, quoting Bobby Bear's country song, I've never gone to bed with an ugly woman, but I've sure woke up with a few. He changed the management. Frank Rooney and Jim Isler, who ran Brown Shoe Company, a more successful operation, eventually shut down Dexter's U.S. operations and moved them overseas. For every dollar they were paying workers in the U.S., it cost a dime to hire employees to make shoes elsewhere. I was wrong about the economic future of that one. The people working in the town of Dexter, Maine, were wonderful people who were very good at what they did. But even if they were twice as good as the Chinese would work for 1/10 as much. Yet even with all this money-spinning activity, Buffett felt that the most important opportunity given him in the aftermath of 9/11 had nothing to do with business. Rather, he now had both the privilege and the responsibility to use his pulpit to influence events and ideas. After the bubble of hubris that had enveloped the financial community for the past several years, America had become more sober-minded and less blind to the corner-cutting in the name of greed that had gone on in the late 1990s. Buffett thought the time was right for him to speak up about the rapacity of the rich and the way it was being validated by fiscal policy. His sense of justice was particularly inflamed by a proposal that was a centerpiece of President Bush's new budget, a plan to gradually repeal the decades-old federal estate tax, which took for the government a slice of the largest inheritances. Supporters of the plan referred to the estate tax as the death tax, which had an ominous sound. The mantra was that death shouldn't be a taxable event. They called the estate tax a barrier to the ambitions of hard-working entrepreneurial people. They cited a proverbial family that would have to sell the family farm to pay the tax when its patriarch died. Undoubtedly, there were some such families. Buffett argued that the suffering of those few was far outweighed by the effect on everybody else. The estate tax was technically not a death tax. It was a gift tax. Anytime someone gave a large gift of money, he paid a gift tax. All gift taxes were a blockade against the return of the robber barons, who controlled so much of the nation's riches through gifts and inheritance in the 19th century that they became like a government unto themselves, a plutocracy, a ruling class based on wealth. The estate tax, however, was paid at a lower effective rate than the tax imposed on gifts from living persons, allowing relatively large posthumous gifts to go untaxed. Buffett used his preacher's pulpit to point out that of the roughly 2.3 million Americans who died each year, fewer than 50,000, 2%, paid any estate tax at all. Half of all the estate taxes paid came from fewer than 4,000 people, 0.2% of those who had died. These were the monumentally, colossally rich, rich on the scale of being able to own a Gulfstream IV, buy the new Maybachs, own a vineyard in France, and wear jewels that looked like rock candy and lemon and lime sour balls. As to the question, it was their money, why shouldn't they be able to do what they wanted with it? Why should they subsidize others? Buffett's answer was that they owed some minimum amount to the society that enabled them to become so rich. If they thought they did it all themselves, reincarnate them as one of five children of a scared, starving mother in Mali and see how rich and successful they would be after being sent to work as a slave on a cocoa plantation in Côte d'Ivoire. If the estate tax were eliminated, he said, somebody else would have to make up the difference, since the same amount of money would still be required to pay for running the government. For years, a supply-side theory had postulated that cutting taxes would force the government to cut expenses. This theory had an intuitive logic. After all, if people were supposed to live within their income, why not the government? Of course, by 2002, the populace was busy setting up home equity lines of credit based on artificially cheap interest rates to avoid living within its income. Debate over supply-side policy still boiled after 20 years. The taxes the government was collecting usually didn't cover its costs, and it was borrowing to make up the difference. The theory by now looked more dubious. Killing the estate tax would mean that the government would have to raise taxes or borrow even more money, and the interest on that debt, along with its ultimate repayment, would eventually be passed on to everybody else in the form of higher taxes. Buffett felt that proposing an estate tax cut while running the federal budget at a deficit was, in fact, the height of hypocrisy. The average person who would pay these higher taxes if the estate tax were repealed would never face an estate tax. The push to repeal the estate tax was not coming from people who owned small ranches in Oklahoma. No, the real push, Buffett said, was coming from a tiny percentage of the country's population, people he actually knew. People who were rich enough, often very suddenly rich enough, to own a triplex penthouse in Manhattan, a 9-bedroom log cabin in Deer Valley, a summer house in Nantucket, and a condo in Costa Rica. Buffett felt that politics had slithered into the hands of people who could pay hush-puppy lobbyists from K Street to whisper in the ear of Congress and funnel political donations where they would do the most good. He didn't blame people for acting in their own interests. He even felt pity for the politicians who were chained to the grindstone of endless fundraising. It was the system that he scorned, in which money bought power. Shortly after President Bush's inauguration in 2001, Buffett had gone to the LBJ room in the Capitol building to speak about political campaign financing to a group of 38 senators who were part of the Democratic Policy Committee, then followed up with appearances on ABC's This Week and CNN's Inside Politics. Buffett said that the campaign finance system was corrupt. The current way of electing politicians had echoes of 19th century Tammany Hall, where votes and influence were literally for sale. The laws were shifting in ways that enhanced the ability of the rich to get even richer, to keep more of what they made, and to pass more of it along to their heirs. Buffett called this government by the wealthy for the wealthy. He pointed out a growing army of hush puppies and tax panderers whose job was to push for legislation that benefited the interests of the rich. He said, however, that nobody lobbied for the other 98% of Americans. Lacking their own lobbyists, the best redress for the 98% was to understand what was going on and to quit voting for people who enacted laws that took taxes out of the average person's pockets so the rich could pay a lower share. Paul Newman, Bill Gates Sr., George Soros, a smattering of Rockefellers, and nearly 200 other rich and influential people agreed and signed a petition published in the New York Times that opposed Bush's plan to eliminate the estate tax. Buffett didn't join the petition because he thought it did not go far enough. He thought that rich people were lucky and blessed, and they should pay taxes. "I don't believe in dynasties," he said. Repealing the estate tax would be like choosing the nation's Olympic teams from the children of past Olympic champions, he added. Wealth is just a bunch of claim checks on the activities of others in the future. You can use that wealth in any way you want to. You can cash it in or give it away. But the idea of passing wealth from generation to generation so that hundreds of your descendants can command the resources of other people simply because they came from the right womb flies in the face of a meritocratic society. I'd have a higher tax at the higher levels of wealth. I wouldn't mind having no tax up to a point, and then 100% tax for an estate over $150 million. The most important thing is to ask, and then what? If you eliminate the $20 billion or so raised by the estate tax, you've got to make the money up by taxing everybody else somehow. It's amazing how hard the American population will fight for the families of those few thousand people who pay large estate taxes and for the whole rest of the country to pay for it out of their own pockets. I don't like anything that, in effect, creates a residue of humanity. I don't like a tax system that goes in that direction. I don't like an educational system that goes in that direction. I don't like anything where the bottom 20% keep getting a poorer and poorer deal. But the debate over estate taxes turned shrill and bitter. Buffett was portrayed as a silver-spooned populist, a rich old crocodile who was trying to keep the next generation from bootstrapping its way to success in the classic American entrepreneurial manner. Dynastic wealth turns a meritocracy upside down, he wrote to Senator Ken Salazar. In effect, it says that the people who should allocate the resources of this country should be the descendants of those who excelled in amassing resources long ago. Subtly or not, the estate tax feud was informed by the issue of Buffett's own money. Some people called rich guys like Buffett tax dodgers because they had amassed their money through lightly taxed investments. But to say that Buffett invested to dodge taxes was like saying that a baby drank its bottle to fill its diapers. Indeed, Buffett was the first to say that the tax on investments was unfairly low. In fact, this was another of his causes. He liked to compare his tax rate to his secretary's, pointing out how unjust it was that she paid a higher tax rate on her income than he did, just because most of his income came from investing.